Welcome back to the third hour of Issues Etc. today. We're continuing a conversation all the way through the end of the program with Dr. Alvin Schmidt. We have barely touched upon the many subjects that are covered in a book he has written called Under the Influence, How Christianity Transformed Civilization. And you can find a very brief summary of that in an article that he has written, the cover story for the latest edition of the Lutheran Witness magazine titled Civilization Transformed. We're talking about the influence of Christianity on Western culture, going through topic by topic, the next topic being the elevation of sexual standards. What were the sexual standards of the Greco-Roman world before the influence of Christianity, and what have they been in Western civilization since? If you'd like to join us, we have phone numbers 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. If you have a question or a comment on the influence of Christianity in the Western world, Dr. Alvin Schmidt, welcome back.
Thank you.
Let's turn our attention to sexual standards. Tell us what the Greco-Roman world was like with regard to sexual behavior, mores, taboos.
Yes. I cite Latin pagan authors from before and at the time of Christianity. For example, Juvenal, in his writings, indicates that chastity and people being addicted to promiscuous, purient sex was common. Ovid, another Roman writer, says, for example, that male-female sex relations had become sadistic and masochistic. Now, this is not a Christian spin. This is pagan writers. Martial, another pagan writer, wrote, for example, in the late first century that, for example, sexual life had become commonly defiled in his day. And as I mentioned earlier, homosexuality, which was primarily pederasty, pedophilia, as we would call it today, was very, very common. Marriage had basically become a joke, if I may use that term. And another historian has said there was nothing in which the Romans did not indulge or in which they thought a disgrace. Bestiality was practiced. When I did the research for this book, I found actually medallions that were found in Gaul, which is now France, showing bestiality portraits that were quite common. And I might mention, bestiality was not just common among the Romans, it was also found among some of the American Indians, among the Hopi, for instance, and in some cases in South America. So whenever, what shall I say, people depart and live as Paul says in Romans 1, God has given them up, they then resort to behavior sexually that is sometimes as bad as what you would find in a barnyard, and sometimes even worse. So that's the context in which Christianity came. Christianity, you know, came into the scene showing that the human body was not an end in itself, that sex was to be used only within marriage to the glory of God, and that husband and wife were supposed to each honor each other. This is a totally, radically different ethic brought into a society that did anything but that. And as I've mentioned many times before, we are slowly reverting to some of this behavior. We still say, for example, that it's wrong to have child molestation, but it's not wrong necessarily for adultery anymore. It's not wrong anymore, for example, to have certain other kinds of sexual deviant behavior. Well, all of this is a departure from Christianity. We even have today an organization that has about 1 million members, as best as I can determine, called North American Man-Boy Love Association. In the year 2000, South Park, an animated show produced by Comedy Central, pictured a character named Eric, who unknowingly came in contact with a real pedophile group. And this was the North American Man-Boy Love Association. One scene in this particular program has a NAMBLA member blasphemously saying, quote, "Thank you, Jesus, for sending a boy who is presumed to want sex with adult men." In a similar manner, another scene refers to another boy as, quote, "a gift from God," end quote. So you see what's happening when you depart from Christianity. You invariably don't stay in a neutral zone. You go back to the pagan behavior that Paul talked about in the first chapter of Romans.
You mentioned also marriage, and you even quote from Gibbon's famous History and Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire when he says the dignity of marriage was restored by the Christians. What was marriage like as an everyday institution in the Greco-Roman world?
Well, it was kind of pitiful in many ways. As I said earlier, kind of a joke, for example. Again, from a pagan writer by the name of Catullus, has a quote where he says, this is at a so-called wedding ceremony, "Raise aloft the torches, boys. I see the wedding veil coming. Go on, sing in measure to Io, Hymen, Hymenaeus. Io, Hymen, Hymenaeus. Today and yesterday you disdained the country wives. Wretched, wretched lover, throw the nuts." This was an example of what was done at a wedding ceremony when people usually are joyous. It was mockery. And it's in this context, for example, that a modern historian said, it was Constantine who revolutionized the state's view of marriage in order to bring it to more in line with Christian ideas. And when we see marriages performed today, pretty dignified, it's the result of a Christian influence. It had basically disappeared among the Greeks and the Romans. And again, Christianity, of course, not only doesn't get any credit, but frequently, as Rodney Dangerfield said, it gets no respect.
Was adultery, the keeping of a mistress, commonplace as the those brief readings?
Yes, very much so. Yes, particularly among the Greeks, but the Romans too. You had the hetaire, which was the woman that could accompany you to the town square, but the wife had to stay at home and take care of the family, take care of the house. And the Greeks made no bones about it, so to speak, that they had a wife to raise children and a mistress for the enjoyment of sex.
What about the issue of polygamy in the ancient world? And now it's taken as, I shouldn't say that. We still would hope that marriage would be considered a monogamous venture, although nowadays those things are even being challenged in our culture. What about in the ancient world?
Well, in the ancient world, the Greeks and the Romans did not practice polygamy, although many other societies did. But they had the same benefits of polygamy by having the hetaireus, or the mistress, in addition to the wife they had. Greek and Roman society did not make it legal, it was illegal, to have two wives, but you could have a concubine in addition to a mistress as well. It's interesting, we also know that polygamy was rather common in the Old Testament. But when you move to the New Testament, Jesus changed that. He changed it, for example, that adultery, for instance, adultery throughout the ancient world until Christ came along, was always defined in terms of a woman's marital status, not the man's. In other words, a married man could have sex with a woman who was single and he was not guilty of adultery. But a married woman having sex with a single man was always guilty of adultery. Now along comes Jesus and says, for example, whosoever looks on woman with lust in his heart has already committed adultery. He didn't say anything make any difference whether the woman was single or married. In fact, he didn't even have to engage in the act. Jesus, in other words, equalized, if you would, or brought about an ethic of equality relative to adultery. What was good for the goose was good for the gander, if I may use a vernacular. That was radically different. That was unheard of in any ancient society, whether it was even among American Indians and the like. Adultery typically was something that the woman, who was man's property, and by engaging in sex with another man, she was in essence violating his property, and therefore highly punishable.
Now, before we leave the issue of sexual standards, to segue nicely, as you have there, to the issue of the dignity of women under the influence of Christianity, there's one other topic, and that is prostitution. In the ancient Greco-Roman world, was it considered to be just part of the fabric of society?
Prostitution was there, and in many cases, we don't have any statistics on it, but it was definitely in existence. But if you had your hetairae on the side, you probably didn't have a desire or need to go to a lot of prostitutes. But not everybody had a hetairae. And so younger guys who weren't married yet among the Greeks and the Romans and soldiers and the like would obviously use, if I may use that term, prostitutes. And hence, as we know, we often call it the oldest profession, which really is not a profession, but that's what it's called.
What about the mixing of prostitution with cultic religions? We hear about temple prostitutes, not only in the very ancient world, but did this also exist around the time Christianity began to have
its influence?
Oh, yes.
It was very common among the Greeks. The goddesses and prostitution and the like. And there was some of that among the Romans, too. Even though the Vestal Virgins were so not supposed to be violated, however they frequently were. And so you had it in connection with religion as well, yes.
Our guest is Dr. Alvin Schmidt. We're talking about the influence of Christianity on Western culture. You can join us. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Alvin Schmidt is Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Illinois College. He has authored the cover story of the latest edition of the Lutheran Witness magazine titled Civilization Transformed, and he is author of the book Under the Influence, How Christianity Transformed Civilization. Let's talk then about something you just mentioned, that is the dignity of women. Before Christianity arrived on the scene by way of influence, what was the status of the woman?
Oh, pitiful. The woman basically was chattel. She was property. She had no dignity. She had no rights. And the ancient literature is full of it, for example, illustrating that women had no rights. And this is not only true among the Greeks and the Romans. To some extent, it was also true among the Hebrews. And this is why many historians argue Christianity grew, because in the early years of Christianity, women frequently, you know, were missionaries, if you will, to bring and spread the gospel. But you have, for instance, let me just cite ancient literature from the Talmud. He who talks with a woman in public brings evil upon himself. Another one, for example, if a man teaches his daughter the law, it's as though he taught her lechery. That was the rabbinic oral law that was in existence at the time of Christ. Well, it was not much different among the Greeks. When the husband, the Greek society, particularly in Athens, had a male guest or guests over, the woman had to retire to her gynecium, which was her private quarters. She could not even dine with him. And then you find a very different thing happening when Christ comes on the scene. He, for example, in John 4, we read that he talked to the Samaritan woman. And if we read closely, we find, for example, that the disciples came and asked him, "What are you doing talking to a woman?" I'm paraphrasing, but they were nonplussed. He treated women, you know, he taught Mary and Martha. Again, this was radically new and different behavior. It was not something that the Greeks did or the Romans did. And this, I might say, in many ways, appealed to women. And so you have even in the New Testament, where Lydia, for example, you have Phoebe, for example, very active in the church. You have Priscilla with her husband Aquila. Or we find even in the book of Luke that women would sometimes go along or follow Jesus. Well, no respectable woman in the eyes of the Greeks and the Romans did that. Yet Jesus never stopped and said, "Hey, listen, you're going against the culture of the day, and you better not follow me or go with me." So it drastically changed the behavior of women. As I sometimes say, if it weren't for Jesus Christ, Gloria Steinem would probably still be wearing a veil.
You also, back to the issue of marriage with regard to the dignity of women, and this has to do with the place of children as well in family life and in the culture of the without the influence of Christianity. You talk about something called, I think you called the pater potestas.
Oh, patria potestas. Pardon me, patria potestas, which in Latin means the father is all-powerful. Yes, this was an institutionalized, in fact, this was part of the 12 tables of the Roman law, table 4, that the father had all power over his family members, including his wife. If he suspected the wife was guilty of adultery, he could summarily execute her. That was the law. There was no inquest or any kind of investigation after that. It was essentially true among the Greeks, too. This particular law then was nullified, or if you may say, repealed, in the 4th century after Christian emperors came into onto the Roman scene. But until then, it existed very, very much so. And so it's an excellent example to show that the woman had no right and that the husband could do it. And it was not just a woman. Any adult children of his. In fact, I have found 2 sources where a Roman man was a soldier and his father didn't like what he did. He had him executed. That was patria potestas. The father is all-powerful. And under patria potestas, you had the manus rule from the Latin word hand. She was under the hand, then usually of the husband that she married. Before that, she was under the father's rule. But even while the children were still alive, and if they were married, the patria potestas still held unless the father formally relinquished it. It was a very powerful force, and it was institutionalized. And the one that we really never read about in even ancient history, but it's one that is obviously very, very much in conflict with all the values that we find about family life in the Bible.
What do you make then of the, and it's a very popular contention, that Christianity, especially its influence in America and Western civilization today, seeks to keep women under the thumb of men, seeks to reinforce a patriarchal society, seeks to put women in a position of subjection?
Yeah, again, I would simply first, when people say that, say, where do women have the most freedom, in Western society or in the Arab societies? As I often say, if, for example, Christianity required women to wear a burqa or a veil, like the Islamic world does, we would hear about it probably every hour on the news. But because the Muslims do it, it is ignored. And I don't think I'm incorrect here. I have often, or most recently, argued that the argument about so-called the violation of church and state, when, for example, a prayer is being said, or in some schools they don't want the children or the high schools to say a prayer among themselves because it's a violation of church and state. At the same time, we've had in California and other states where in the public schools, even in grade school, children are asked to wear Muslim garb in order to understand the Muslim religion. Now, if you had anyone wear a Christian cross, the ACLU would become apoplectic. So I say it's not so much, I think, that it's a concern about violation of church and state. It is a hatred against Christianity. And I hope Christians would begin to realize what's going on. There's a double standard that is surfacing today that is not applied to non-Christian groups. And it's, well, required reading in the University of North Carolina last fall about Islam. Well, try and have required reading for all the freshmen on some Christian book. You know what the result would be. All H would break loose. And it's okay if you do it as a non-Christian group. It's another way of really bashing Christianity, minimizing it, and what else can I say? It's a double standard and an unfortunate, and we as Christians, I think, need to write to our elected representatives when this happens. But frequently, we don't. Most of the time, we don't.
With the few minutes left to us before this break, this is an area that I hadn't even considered, the influence of Christianity in Western civilization when it comes to both public charity and to what we call today healthcare or hospitals.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, yeah, one of the most interesting things is that there were no hospitals in existence until Christianity came along. The first inkling of it was at the Council of Nicaea when, in 325, bishops were supposed to, in their diocese, have a hospice. Then in 369, the first formal hospital was built in the East, then in the West, and hospitals just kept spreading. And even to this day, as I like to remind people, you drive by a hospital and it frequently still bears a Christian name. It may be honored and bear the name of a saint like St. Luke or St. John or St. Joseph, or if not that, it often carries the name of a denomination: Lutheran Hospital, Baptist Hospital, Methodist Hospital, Presbyterian Hospital. Every time we drive by that, we should think, here is the influence of Christianity. And why there were no hospitals, and I've done a lot of research on it, I cannot find any evidence among the Greeks and the Romans. There was a little bit that resembled perhaps hospital care in the Roman army, but there were no institutionalized hospitals as we have them. That started with Christianity. Similarly with compassion. One of the things that is noteworthy is that the Romans had two words. One was caritas, from which we get the word charity, and the other one was liberalitas. Liberalitas was when you did something for someone and wanted something in return, like a politician, if I may use that example. But caritas, where you gave out of love and expected nothing in return. And this is what the early Christians did. And we have even the pagan emperor by the name of Julian, who only ruled for 2 years in 361 through 363, mentioned, for example, that much as he disliked the Christians and called them the Galileans pejoratively, that Christians did charity not just for their own, but even for the pagans. And then he said, wish it would be similar among the pagans, but it wasn't. So charity, again, and manifested by hospitals, is a Christian stamp on society that we all take for granted. Now, had Christianity not been in the scene, when would hospitals have surfaced? I don't know. But certainly not at the same time that Christianity brought them on the scene. And why did Christianity bring on the scene? Well, they were following what Jesus said. I was sick and you cared for me. You know, and whomever you gave a cup of cold water, you gave it to me. There was the motive. There was the principle. It was an act of love as a result of being knowledgeable and convicted by the gospel of Jesus Christ.
You know, this seems to me, folks, to be one of those areas. Why didn't I ever realize that charity in hospitals, the people caring for the sick, had it at its root a Christian influence in the culture? It's because you take these things for granted. You do, as Dr. Schmidt has asserted here, you do assume that there always have been these things. Well, the fact of the matter isn't. There haven't always been, and some of them are the direct product of the influence of Christians in the world. You can read more about this in Dr. Schmidt's book called Under the Influence, How Christianity Transforms Civilization. You can have this book for your own directly through our radio program. We'll send you the hardcover book for a contribution of $25 to Issues Etc. Now, that price does include shipping and handling. You can pay by check as well. It's a $25 check payable to Issues Etc. and mailed to Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. That's Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can pay by credit card, have your MasterCard, your Visa, or your Discover card ready, and call our resource line 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. The book you asked for is called Under the Influence by Dr. Alvin Schmidt, 1-800-737-0172. When we come back, has Christianity been a barrier to science? Has it been standing in the way of science throughout its influence in Western civilization? We'll find out. Dr. Alvin Schmidt is our guest, Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Illinois College. Stay with us.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Some of the most common ethical dilemmas that confront Christians today are found in the workplace. Do we operate by one set of ethics as Christians and another set in the business world? As you face workplace problems, where do you go to look for guidance? Answers to these questions and more are found in the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June, Christian Ethics in the Workplace, by Raymond Hilgert, Phil Lacus, and James Truesdell. You can order Christian Ethics in the Workplace by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours at 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or order the book online at issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section and you'll find information on this book. It's the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June, Christian Ethics in the Workplace. 1-800-325-3040.
Why are seals able to violate the basic rules of diving? The answer next on today's Creation Moment. And now, here's our Creation Moment host, Ian Taylor.
The water pressure around a human diver increases as he goes into deeper water. As the pressure increases, his blood is able to hold more dissolved oxygen. Our blood also absorbs the nitrogen in the air around us. If a diver were to move towards the surface too quickly, the nitrogen would start to bubble out of his blood. These bubbles can block the flow of blood to muscles, organs, and even the brain, leading to death. This painful condition is called the bends. Scientists have wondered why seals don't get the bends. Weddell seals dive to far greater depths than human divers would consider, even using the best equipment. The fact that they are breaking every diving rule in the book means that almost every dive should lead to a fatal case of the bends. To find the answer to this mystery, scientists outfitted four seals with scientific backpacks. These allowed scientists to record the seals' heart rates, sample blood, and record the depth of their dives. The deeper the seals went, the more nitrogen accumulated in their blood. But just before the nitrogen reached a dangerous point, it leveled off. Scientists say that the tiny sacs in the lungs that absorb oxygen and nitrogen just shut down. Then the seal's heart, liver, and blubber begin to absorb the nitrogen from the blood. The air exchange sacs in the lungs reactivate as the seal ascends to the surface. Surely, the amazing biology that allows the seal to make his living deep in the ocean could only have been designed by our Creator God.
For a printed transcript of today's program, call 1-800-42-BIBLE. That's 1-800-422-4253. And be sure to join us again next time for another Creation Moment.
It's 5:32. Good evening. AM 850 KFUO weather, cloudy overnight, 50 the low. Tomorrow mostly cloudy with a high of 71. Right now it is cloudy in St. Louis and 56. In traffic, westbound 40 between McCausland and I-70. Make that 170. Slow traffic and west of 270 out to Mason. Then slow again from the Chesterfield Airport out to Route K. Northbound 270 at Dorset Road. Heavy traffic in the right lanes up to the 70 exits. Westbound 70 from the airport out a little slow towards 270, then crowded from 270 across the Blanchet Bridge and slow from 5th Street out to 94. Southbound 170 between Forest Park Parkway and 40, slow traffic in the right lane. Eastbound 40 between Union Station and the Poplar Street Bridge, slow there. And northbound 55 between 44 and the Poplar Street Bridge, slow traffic in the right lane.
AMA 50 KFUO is underwritten in part by Reliable Heating and Cooling, with a showroom in the Mid-County Trade Center, 8463 Delport Drive. Reliable Heating and Cooling features Lennox air conditioning and furnace systems and services all brands. Reliable also provides senior discounts. Reliable Heating and Cooling, serving you from North, Mid, and West County exchanges. The next time you call Reliable at 423-3535, please thank them for being an AMA 50 KFUO underwriter.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. Folks, we're talking about the influence of Christianity on Western culture, and we're talking with Dr. Alvin Schmidt. He's authored this book called Under the Influence, How Christianity Transformed Civilization. If you have a question or a comment on the influence of Christianity in Western culture, perhaps you have been confronted by one of those persons who says, hey, what about the Crusades? Or what about the Christian opposition to abolition in the South during the Civil War? What about this? What about that? He has answers, and he's done the research. The phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We have some more topics to cover with him, but we got plenty of time to take your phone calls. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. The best caller during this next 25 minutes of the program will receive a free copy of Dr. Schmidt's book called Under the Influence, How Christianity Transformed Civilization. It's well worth a call at 505-7850 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Schmidt, let's turn our attention to the question of science. It is commonly asserted, especially today, that just about everything Christian, its worldview, its morality, and its view of man and the world, especially its teaching of creation, is contrary to science. As a matter of history, as Christianity has influenced civilization, has it stood in the way of science or furthered it?
Well, as I argue in the book, science has its origins in Christianity. And this is not just Christians saying it. For example, Alfred North Head White, a renowned philosopher of science, not a Christian, I believe he was an atheist, said once, quote, "Faith in the possibility of science generated antecedently to the development of modern scientific theory is an unconscious derivative from medieval theology," end of quote. Another historian has said that, for example, the medieval monk was an intellectual ancestor of the scientist, and even the German physicist, Ernst Mach, once remarked, "Every unbiased mind must admit that the age in which the chief development of science of mechanics took place was in an age of predominantly theological cast." Now, one can find more of these quotes, but that should basically make the point. Today, basically, Christianity and science are seen as they are basic enemies at opposite ends of the pole. You know, and I've asked myself the question over the years, when and how did that happen? Because until about 150 years ago, you couldn't find a scientist who was not only a Christian, but who tried to integrate his scientific theories or relate it to his Christian understanding, much less divorce it from it. And this is true whether you look at great men of science like Kepler, whether you look at people like Copernicus, whether you look at people like James Simpson, Robert Boyle, from whom we get Boyle's Law in chemistry, often also called the father of chemistry, or whether it was Louis Pasteur. You know, Louis Pasteur, from I just used, when he died, he held his wife's hand in one hand and a crucifix in the other hand. One of the greatest scientists, after whom we've named the pasteurization process, who discovered basically bacteria. Or Kepler. I like to mention him because Kepler gave science, astronomy, the first three planetary laws that astronomers are dependent upon to this day. Kepler was only about 4 months shy of being ordained as a Lutheran pastor, and was a Lutheran all his life, persecuted for it, lost his position more than once because he was supposed to conform to Catholic theology when he was in Austria and in other places. And he was very much influenced by pagan thinking, namely Aristotelian thinking, which was operated, for example, on even after his day. Aristotle taught many things, but one of the things that he taught was the most perfect thing in this world was a circle. And everybody believed that, including Kepler. And when Kepler was trying to determine the motion of the planets, it didn't work out. Finally, he struck upon the idea that maybe it's not a perfect circle, but an elliptical orbit. And sure enough, so his first law that we have today is that planets, as most high school students know, revolve in an elliptical fashion, not in a perfect circle. This is a major breakaway from Aristotelian thinking. His second law was that he also discovered that the planets move faster when they're closer to the sun than when they're farther from the sun. That's his second law. So he came up with three laws. The third one's harmonic law, which is a little more complicated to explain. But here was a devout Christian. And it's not just Kepler, but even the people who laid the foundation before Kepler from the 13th century, really, like Robert Grosseteste, the first chancellor of Oxford University, a Franciscan bishop. Roger Bacon was a devout believer in the truthfulness of Scripture, even though he was arguing that truth should be derived, if at all possible, inductively or empirically. He always saw the Bible in the light of sound reasoning and verifiable by human experience. Then later on, Francis Bacon, a couple hundred years later, another devout scientist. By the way, and they were sometimes persecuted. By whom? Yes, some flawed, I may use the word, ignorant Christians who were tied to Aristotelian thinking rather than to divorce themselves. So the conflict that often existed between the church leaders and the science was not the result of what they derived from the Bible, but they took an Aristotelian philosophy and superimposed it upon the Bible and therefore thought there was a conflict, but there really wasn't. I can go on, but you may have another question or two.
Well, what about the question of Galileo? It's often asserted that Galileo, when he was attempting to reconcile the theories of Copernicus and talking about that the Earth is not the center of the universe or even of the solar system, was persecuted by the official church for holding these views.
Yeah, I'm glad you bring that up, and I discussed that in the book. Galileo, by the way, was less pro-Copernican than Kepler. In fact, he didn't like what Kepler came up with at all. He was still very much, in many ways, tied to the Ptolemaic system, which is opposite to the so-called heliocentric system, which basically Kepler brought on the scene more so than Copernicus. But the people who persecuted, if I may use that word, Galileo were his own Roman Catholic friends. The Lutherans and the Calvinists never did this. For example, Copernicus' book, published in 1543, was underwritten, Osiander helped underwrite it. And Radicus, the mathematician, encouraged him to publish it. And the Lutheran leader gave money for it. The book was basically published as a result of Lutheran urging and support. Never will you find that in, for example, in any science book. And the Calvinists, likewise, were very pro-Copernican theory. Melanchthon, before he died, as he studied Copernicus, he respected his theories more and more. So we find an awful lot of things that are said that are often not true. As I mentioned, Copernicus, you know, was writing by Osiander, the guy who helped translate it. Radicus, a mathematician who came from the University of Wittenberg. Duke Albrecht and Brahe and Kepler, all of these made it possible for Copernicus to publish his book called The Revolution of the Heavenly Bodies. The Latin title is much longer than that. So, again, when the church is indicted, carte blanche, it's not true. It was just a segment of the church, in this case, the Roman Catholic Church.
Another indictment that's often leveled at Christianity's influence in civilization has to do with what is commonly viewed as kind of an anti-intellectualism of Christianity, in particular when it comes to the area of education. Tell us about the influence of Christianity in the world of education.
Yeah, well, you see, Christianity, given its basic premises and positions, namely that, as Jesus says, go ye therefore and teach all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit, was premised on the idea of Christianity is going to survive. If it's going to thrive, it has to be taught. This requires education. And so we have, very early in the life of the Christian church, catechetical schools that came on the scene, already in the second century, which developed into more, you know, liberal arts-oriented institutions in time. But Christianity has always been pro-education because Christianity does not survive or thrive on ignorance. And Christians throughout the ages, those who were informed, all of the, whether they were theologians or whether they were early scientists or whether they were other individuals, never spurned knowledge. In fact, the Bible has many, many citations where it gives honor and praise to knowledge. My people perish because they lack knowledge, is one of the Old Testament statements. So to say that Christianity is anti-intellectual is simply not true. Again, people have used these arguments and distorted it. And to take a look, for example, where were all the early universities, beginning with the 12th century, with the University of Bologna, and all the University of Paris and Oxford and all of these, all were Christian institutions, even in this country. Many colleges still bear Christian names or are affiliated with them. Yale was started as a Christian school. Harvard before that was started as a school for the Congregationalists and the like. Likewise with Princeton. Christianity, no, was on the forefront of education. Never was it opposed to it.
We're talking with Dr. Alvin Schmidt about the influence of Christianity on Western culture. He is Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Illinois College, author of the book Under the Influence, How Christianity Transformed Civilization, and author of the cover story in the latest edition of the Lutheran Witness magazine titled Civilization Transformed. If you have a question or a comment, our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Car phone callers, first-time callers, and internet callers will get top priority. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We're often told, Dr. Schmidt, that the system of justice that we enjoy in Western civilization, but yet primarily in America, is a product of Roman influence in the world, that it was the Romans from whom we derive much of our legal concepts, our legal systems, and our concept of justice. Where does the influence of Christianity fall in there?
Yeah, Rome contributed to a system of law and justice, if you will, in terms of its orderliness and procedure, rather than specific underlying ethical, moral content. Let me, for example, illustrate this. Already in the Old Testament, you find that you had to have two or more eyewitnesses, according to Deuteronomy and the like, in order for a person to be judged guilty and executed for a major crime. That precedes the Romans. Then you have, for instance, in Christianity that I discovered, it's, guy never gets credit. As far as I know, I think I'm the first guy giving him credit for it, is St. Ambrose. St. Ambrose was a bishop in Milan, Italy. In the year 390, Theodosius I, a Christian emperor now, overreacted to a riot that took place in Thessalonica, and he ended up butchering 7,000 people, most of them innocent ones. And he happened to live at that time as a Roman emperor in Milan likewise. Bishop Ambrose called him on the carpet and says, "You're going to repent. If you don't, I'll excommunicate you." Initially he didn't, but finally he came to the cathedral in sackcloth and ashes and repented. What Ambrose told Theodosius I, the emperor, "You are not above the law." Now this is a basic principle in Western democracies to this day. We hear it again and again on television. That's the first origin of it. The Romans didn't talk about someone not being above the law. The emperors were always above the law and other people of significant influence. This is a Christian principle that first surfaced, as far as I can tell, in the history of mankind. 800 years later, it was further, shall I say, supported and enhanced with the Magna Carta in 1215, when we had outside the city of London in the little town of Runnymede at that time, the people confronting King John with the sword and say, "You're going to sign this large chart," which is what Magna Carta means. "You are not above the law, even though you're king." And we all know, if you read American history and the philosophy underlying the American Constitution and the Bill of Rights, that, for example, the Magna Carta was a major influence in the American system of law, liberty, and justice. Well, the roots of them go back to Christianity. I said St. Ambrose and the Magna Carta. Now, the Magna Carta, at first blush, may feel like the Christians had nothing to do with it, but not so. Stephen Langdon, who was Archbishop of Canterbury, was one of the main individuals in it. And when you read the preface to it, it says, "John, by the grace of God," it begins talking that way. So you see, again, the influence of the Magna Carta had a lot to do with the Christian influence. You might even argue that the idea of putting down laws and constitutions as we have it, in a sense, perhaps was influenced by the Christians writing formal creeds. The Romans and the Greeks formally, as a rule, didn't have written laws, creeds as such, except of 12 tables of laws, which were pretty general. They weren't specific in terms of detail in many cases. But the fact that the Christians wrote a creed was, in a sense, sending down a standard of writing things down, which is another I guess you might say, ancillary contribution to our system of law and justice. Our laws have to be written down. They're not operated orally.
Let's go back to the phones and talk with Al, who's calling from his car. Al, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd. Did the Crusades lead to the expansion of hospitals, orphanages, and schools throughout Asia Minor and the Near East?
Yes.
And I'll hang up and listen on the phone.
Yes, they did. In fact, that's one of the things that is often, again, not mentioned. Many of the hospitable orders, so to speak, that many of them surfaced, and hospitals were built, for example, where the Christians, even in the East, serviced Muslims as well as Christians. Yes, very much so.
Al, I'd like you to call back if you have an opportunity at 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. I'd like to send you a free copy of Dr. Schmidt's book called Under the Influence. Our phone number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Schmidt, we spoke briefly before about the abolition of slavery. If you would go into just a bit more detail in the time left to us,
sure,
about how Christians in particular brought about and were active in the abolitionist movement.
Well, first of all, your early abolitionists in this country were predominantly clergy, one group, and then later on a lot of lay Christians joined the group. They're, overwhelmingly influenced by Christians. And so the whole movement had, well, again, had Christianity not been on the scene, when would it have arisen? I don't know. If anybody's guess as good as mine. And we've had individuals, as I said earlier, that were influenced in this country by what happened in England roughly 30 years before. In the England, it was outlawed in 1833, slavery across the Roman Empire. The British Empire. And then, of course, it spread in this country with not only the abolitionist movement at places like Oberlin College in Ohio, also at a seminary in Cincinnati that was congregationally linked. And you had then the book written by Harriet Beecher Stowe, whom, when Abraham Lincoln met her, said, well, this is the little lady that caused the big war. And it was interesting. I grew up in Canada, as some of you may know, but I had never read Uncle Tom's Cabin. I heard about it. And I thought, well, I better read this book. But since then, I've discovered, actually before then, most Americans haven't read it either. And why am I saying this? Well, if you read that book, you'll be surprised to see how it is interlarded with scriptural passages and statements for her argument against slavery. It also is interesting that Uncle Tom, the chief character in the book, she pictures him basically as a suffering servant, in the words of Isaiah, or a Christian who understands the theology of the cross. So there's a tremendous amount of Christian, may I use the word philosophy or theology, in that particular book, and she had a tremendous influence on the abolition of slavery. You also had a fellow by the name of Garrison, who once burned a copy of the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, again, fighting for the removal of slavery. And it was not just clergy, but it was also laymen involved. You have, for example, right across the river from St. Louis, a statue. I took a picture of it, and it happens to be in the book, commemorating Elijah Lovejoy, who was a Presbyterian clergy and often called the first martyr of the abolitionist movement or the preceding American Civil War, when he was killed in 1837 in his print shop in Alton. And you had people, for example, that founded colleges like Berea College in Kentucky. They were modeled on the College of Oberlin in Ohio. Again, they were racially integrated schools. The college from which I retired, Illinois College, had as its president, as I mentioned earlier in the phone conversation today, was Edward Beecher, the brother of Harriet Stowe Beecher. And at that time, Illinois College was, by the Springfield paper, called a place of radical abolitionists. But they were, you know, as Beecher, Beecher was an ordained Presbyterian clergyman, as was, you know, were some of the others. So again, the whole abolitionist movement of slavery cannot be divorced from Christian influence, the act of Christian participation. There's one other thing that is never mentioned in our history books.
We've got about one minute here.
Okay,
Dr.
In 1688, a German by the name of Daniel Pastorius in Pennsylvania, a Mennonite, issued the first proclamation against slavery in 1688 in this country. That's another very interesting thing that is ignored in history. But there you see again, another Christian influence 100 years before Harriet Beecher Stowe, essentially, or 200 years for.
Dr. Alvin Schmidt, thank you very much for being our guest here on Issues Etc. again.
Well, thank you. It's been my pleasure to be with you, and I hope that people not only read the book, but read the article in Lutheran Witness and be able to counter some of the, what I call, false cliches that are often levied at Christianity. And we need to stand up and, as Peter says, give reason for the hope that lies within us.
Dr. Alvin Schmidt is Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Illinois College. He's author of the book Under the Influence, How Christianity Transformed Civilization. And he's also author of that cover story in the latest edition of the Lutheran Witness magazine titled Civilization Transformed. Folks, if you've enjoyed this discussion on the influence of Christianity on Western culture, you'll need a little further research, I think, as well to broaden this, and that would come in the form of a Confessional Christian Worldview Seminar that's going to be held June the 20th through the 28th at the Schwann Center in northern Wisconsin, 2 hours north of the Twin Cities up in Trego, Wisconsin, June the 20th through the 27th, a Confessional Christian Worldview Seminar, getting the big picture on some of the details we've been talking about during this hour and a half with Dr. Alvin Schmidt. During that seminar, you'll hear subjects like Darwinism's failure, Catholicism today, theological liberalism, postmodernism and hypersecularism, and we'll also talk about the grandeur and misery of American evangelicalism, all these worldviews that contradict the Christian worldview in the Confessional Christian Worldview Seminar, June the 20th through the 27th in Trego, Wisconsin. Now, if you want more information on this seminar, the details and the cost, call 1-800-577-4848. That's the Schwann Center's toll-free number, 1-800-577-4848. Or you can go to our website any time of day or night, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New link, and you'll find information and details on a Confessional Christian Worldview Seminar, June the 20th through the 27th in Trego, Wisconsin. 1-800-577-4848 or visit our website, issuesetc.org. Now, you don't have to go and spend your entire week up there. You can go and get one of their flexible packages and spend some time going to one or two of them. We'll be there broadcasting live, by the way, on a couple days of the seminar. Again, the number 1-800-577-4848 or visit our website, issuesetc.org.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.